Welcome to my talk on Stitching the Gadgets. My name is Luca Davi, and this is joint work with my student Daniel Lehmann, my advisor Amatrice Sadeghi, and our collaborator Fabian Monrose. The main motivation behind our work is driven by the following open research question. Does any tool exist that provides practical and secure mitigation against code reuse attacks? Or more precisely, is there any defense that breaks Turing completeness of return-oriented programming attacks? Fortunately, there has been a lot of research over the last few years on defending against return-oriented programming. And many solutions have been recently proposed that provide coarse-grained control flow integrity, or short CFI. Some of these solutions have been even awarded with Microsoft's Blue Hat Prize and have been integrated into Microsoft security tool Emmet. I think this is a great step that Microsoft is asking the security community for ideas to defend against return-oriented programming and also put them into practice into a tool that every one of us can download. Unfortunately, although these solutions present many new ideas, we have to bring the bad news that they can be all bypassed. This brings me to our contributions. First, we did a systematic security analysis where we point out the conceptual weaknesses of all these coarse-grained CFI solutions. Our attack is generic, meaning that we are not interested in breaking a specific tool, but in examining the general security offered by coarse-grained CFI. Moreover, in contrast to related work, we show that our attack is Turing complete, which is important as the intentional motivation behind return-oriented programming was to give an attacker full freedom in program execution as in conventional code injection attacks. Based on this Turing-complete gadget set, we transformed existing real-world exploits and showed that we can even bypass these defenses under a very strong adversary model, where we only assume a small code base of a library that is linked to dozens of applications on Windows. Before I go into the details of our attack, I want to briefly recall the assumptions and adversary model of return-oriented programming. Consider for this an application's memory layout, where we distinguish between code and data area. The main application code resides in the code area and links to a number of shared libraries. The adversary first needs to have a vulnerability in the application to hijack the control flow. A typical example is a buffer overflow error. Moreover, he needs to know the memory layout of the application. This can be achieved by memory disclosure attacks. And as our recent work on just-in-time return-oriented programming shows, these attacks are quite realistic and can even bypass fine-grained randomization. Based on that memory layout, he can then identify and construct gadgets and later on combine these gadgets to a return-oriented programming exploit that gets injected into the data area of the application. Now, how can we defend against this attack? One general principle is control flow integrity. The main idea is as follows. Consider an application where we can abstract its corresponding control flow graph. The nodes in this graph represent the basic blocks. Now, CFI, as proposed by Microsoft Research in 2005, marks each of these BBL with a unique label. Second, it also rewrites exit instruction to include a CFI check. For instance, in this example, the exit of A needs to target label B, which is the beginning of BBLB. And if the control flow would be redirected to C, then there is a clear CFI violation. Original CFI has the main benefit that it provides fine-grained protection against runtime attacks. However, there are some practical limitations. One is performance overhead. More importantly, it requires information which are rarely available, like debug symbols. And then there is this black box Vulkan, which is used for static analysis to derive the control flow graph. And unfortunately, this framework is not yet published, and we don't really know how precise the control flow graph and how indirect branches are resolved by CFI. In order to tackle some of these deficiencies, coarse-grained CFI has been proposed, which aims at practical CFI for real-world deployment. The general idea is as follows. Again, we have an application's control flow graph where each node is labeled is marked with a unique label. Coarse-grained CFI now makes a trade-off between security and efficiency. by reducing the numbers of labels and simplifying CFI checks. This, of course, introduces new control flow paths, which have been never intended by the application. And in the worst case, they may result in a malicious pass that an attacker can exploit. To tackle some of these new false negatives, CFI solutions use heuristics, to which I will come in just a few moments. First, we look at the design of recent solutions. As already presented in the previous talk, we have KBounce and RobPacker that exploit a recent feature of Intel x86, namely the last branch record, to retrieve branching information and enforce on, based on that information, CFI. RobGuard or Microsoft Emmet also hooks into WinAPI functions, but inspects the stack for return addresses pointing to gadgets. Then CFI for Quartz binaries and also CCFIR follows the traditional CFI idea by using binary instrumentation, but every one of these solutions is not using the fine-grained policies, only coarse-grained CFI policies. In our assessment, we identified these policies, but due to the limited time in this presentation, we focus on the two main policies. The first one concerns call-preceded instructions, or sequences, where a return only is allowed to target a call-preceded or a valid call site. Consider for this an example where we have different call instructions, and just the instruction after each of those calls is considered as a call site, which a return is allowed to target. Of course, it cannot target any other instructions in the middle. CFI policy 2 covers the behavior-based heuristics on sequence lengths. And different tools, as presented in the previous talk, use different thresholds. The idea is to track the number of instructions between two indirect branches, and given a certain threshold n, the next sequence to be executed must be greater, must have more than s instructions. If not, then there is a clear CFI violation. This table summarizes our analysis of the individual tools against these two CFI policies. And we also included the time of CFI check, which is important because we need to know when CFI validation is triggered. How can we read this table? Consider, for instance, RobPacker. It does not apply CFI policy 1, but it applies CFI policy 2 on sequence heuristics and triggers CFI validation whenever there is a program leave from true pages or a critical function is called. Now, we did this analysis for each of those tools and then took the most restrictive setting in our Uber CFI. This tool combines all the individual tools and takes the most restrictive setting. Specifically, it applies CFI policy 1, CFI policy 2, and triggers CFI validation at any time. Meaning, this setting is not enforced by any of the tools individually. If you, for instance, check KBouncer, it applies CFI policy 1 and 2, but it only triggers CFI validation at when a WinAPI is called, which makes it vulnerable to flushing attacks, as we have seen recently. In order now to find gadgets that bypass coarse-grained CFI, we followed or we used a methodology that is similar to related work in this field. However, we restrict ourselves to a small code base. Specifically, we chose kernel32DLL, which is a standard library nearly linked to every application on Windows and only 800 kilobyte in size. We then also wrote a filter program, which facilitates our gadget search by giving us filters for registers, instructions, and operands to have subsets of sequences. This methodology allowed us to identify a Turing-complete gadget set on this library. In particular, we have gadgets for loading registers, for loading any of the general-purpose registers in x86, gadgets for loading and storing from and to memory, arithmetic and logical gadgets, and also to satisfy Turing completeness, conditional and unconditional branch gadgets. The details of all these gadgets is in the paper, and we also discussed in detail how we compensate side effects, which is an issue if we only call preceded sequences. We also identified other useful gadgets like function call gadgets, which support the STD call calling convention and CDA-ECL. Now, these gadgets all use call-preceded sequences, allowing us to bypass CFI policy 1. However, we still cannot launch return anti-programming attacks as CFI policy 2 deploys behavioral heuristics, stopping us from having a chain of short sequences. So in order to evade detection, we constructed and developed a general long knob gadget which handles side effects, which is robust enough to resist threshold changes and can be placed at an arbitrary place in the ROP chain. The idea is as follows. We choose a long sequence which performs many controlled memory writes of static values in a small data memory area. And how can we call this gadget? The workflow is as follows. First, we have the real return onto programming gadget performing some actual task for our attack. Afterwards, we store the registers which are in use or which will be affected by the long knob gadget. In particular, we store them on a designated memory area on the stack. In this example, we store ESI, EDI, and EBX. Afterwards, we will prepare the long knob sequence by initializing ESI and EDI to point to the beginning of that small data memory area. Next, the long knob sequence is executed, performs the static controlled memory writes of the static values, and conveniently resets as a side effect the registers that we saved before. This allows us to call the next gadget, and of course we can repeat that until the attack has been finished. In order to demonstrate the effectiveness of our attack, we took two real-world exploits, which are both detected by Coarse-Grain CFI and also Microsoft Emmet, and transformed them based on our Turing-complete gadget set and based on our long-knob gadget to successfully exploit these applications. Now, what are the lessons learned? Or more precisely, what are the fundamental problems behind coarse-grained CFI? First, there are way too many call sites available, meaning that there are too many call-preceded sequences that an attacker can exploit to even on a very small code base launch Turing-complete return onto programming attacks. One way to tackle this problem is to come back to the original CFI idea, which uses a shadow stack and restrict returns to the original caller. The second lesson that we learned is that heuristics are simply ad hoc defenses and are proven to be ineffective given our general long knob gadget, which compensates side effects and can be placed at any arbitrary place in our return to programming gadget chain. So one might argue we can also adjust the thresholds in K-Bounce and RobPicker. However, we did an experiment on a large set of benchmarks where we identified that even the thresholds currently in use by K-Bounce and RobPicker lead to many false positives if applied continuously on the program execution. So definitely heuristics is not the best way to defend against return anti-programming attacks. The third lesson concerns indirect jumps and calls. There are still in coarse-grained CFI too many indirect jump and call targets, and we all know resolving these indirect jumps is a hard problem. Even coming back to original CFI, we still have this black box, and we don't really know how it resolves indirect jumps and calls. So maybe one compromise we can make here is to leverage compiler support to give us some more information on the real targets of indirect jumps and calls. And there's also recent work on CFI presented at USENIX tomorrow, which already tackles a specific problem of VTable pointers. In summary, we systematically analyzed coarse-grained CFI solutions and showed a generic and Turing-complete attack based on a very small code base. We also provide real-world exploits on Windows and also a proof-of-concept exploit on Linux. And in our ongoing work, we aim at tackling these attacks by enforcing fine-grained CFI. In particular, we are deeply collaborating with Intel to have a hardware-software co-design to prevent such attacks. And we also started a collaboration with Microsoft to improve the Microsoft Emmet ROP engine. There are still also some future work and open research questions we need to tackle. For instance, most of the research focuses on CFI for static program execution. But we still need to find ways how to protect applications that dynamically generate code. Moreover, we aim at also working on improved code randomization schemes. This concludes my talk, and I'm happy to take your questions now.
Okay, again, we've got plenty of time for questions. Please come up to the microphone.
Hi, I'm Chao Zhang from UC Berkeley. I have a question about the RP gadget. How do you determine whether a gadget is a knob? For example, when you find several gadgets, you chain them together, and maybe one of the gadgets has several side effects and will affect the other gadgets.
Correct. In our work, because we use a very small code base, we have some gadgets that have also side effects, but we found also gadgets to compensate these side effects. So we also included that in our paper.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question. So. Any more questions?
I think I have one. When we get into thinking about compiler defenses and next steps, one thing that seems important to me is what's the initial step of the vulnerability? Is it like a buffer overflow on the stack or heap vulnerability? Some of the defenses go particularly not sort of against the whole ROP chain, but against that first step. Could you mention briefly what the initial vulnerabilities were in your examples?
So in our proof of concept exploits, we used stack overflows. But in our other related work on JITROP, for instance, we also used heap overflows. But it is definitely true that we have to follow both directions. So one direction is how to prevent return onto programming execution. But another one is how can we build software more secure and more bug-free. That's definitely a direction we need to follow as well.
Thanks. Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Lucas again.